Screen Time with John Fardy. This is News Talk.
Hello and welcome to Screen Time. I'm John Fardy and this is News Talk's TV and movie show. This week on the show, acclaimed horror director Corin Hardy talks to me about his new movie, Whistle, all about an Aztec death whistle playing havoc in a school in America with some dissolute teenagers. Oscar nominee John Kelly talks to me about attending this week's Oscar lunch and, of course, his short nominated movie retirement plan. And Wuthering Heights, its latest adaptation, is back on the big screen and we let you know what all the fuss is about. You can email me screentime@newstalk.com. This show is available as a podcast every Friday at 5 p.m. on the Go Loud app or wherever you get your podcasts, and it's on the radio every Saturday at 6 p.m. here on News Talk. Good weekend to you all. And talking of 6 p.m. on Saturdays on News Talk, in the latest round of Jane LaLaw radio figures, we added a new 2,000 listeners. So thank you, whoever you are. It takes us up to a nice even 30,000 people tuning in every Saturday evening. So thank you. And thank you to all the people who listen on podcasts and indeed all the people who email every week, screentime@newstalk.com, to let me know what they're watching on the big and small screen. We do greatly appreciate it. I kind of have a strange lilt in my voice where I'm going up and down for some reason. I'm not sure why. I think it's because, you know, false humility about bragging about 2,000 new listeners. That's given me this strange affected intonation in my voice momentarily. But look, I've gotten rid of it. And you're welcome to the show. Now, this week in TV, I was watching this.
Alice is going to be heading off to college soon.
I'm going to play soccer in Connecticut!
How are you dealing with it?
All I want is for her to live with me until I die peacefully. And then she can go off and make whatever mistakes a young woman in her 70s might make.
Well, that sounds healthy.
I know I gotta move on, but I'm so stuck, man.
Now, that is a clip from season 3 of Shrinking on Apple TV. This is a dramedy that I have previously raved about. Jason Segel plays a therapist who is getting over the death of his wife and trying to raise his daughter. Because he's kind of lost, he comes up with this idea of giving it straight to his patients and not kind of walking on eggshells and giving them kind of unorthodox advice. And the first two seasons were terrific. Now, I had real misgivings about season 3 because season 2 ended in a perfect fashion. One of the storylines was that I mentioned his dead wife was that him and his daughter were attempting to forgive the drunk driver who killed his wife, played by Brett Goldstein. And it ended kind of beautifully, season 2, where he kind of sits down beside him and they partially make amends. And I just thought it was a perfect ending. So when I heard there was going to be a season 3, I wasn't wildly enamored. So what's season 3 like? It's been on Apple for about 3 weeks. It's okay. Here's the thing. Jimmy, that's the Jason Segel character, you know, he's hoping to have a better life now that he's in essence forgiven the man who took away so much in his life. But of course, that wouldn't make a good TV show. So what kind of happens is he encounters more problems, primarily with his neighbors and his friends and his patients in his life. And his daughter, might, as you heard there, might be going off to college. Harrison Ford, who is brilliant in this, who's kind of his mentor and the head therapist in the clinic that he's in, has Parkinson's. That became apparent at the end of seasons 2. Not Harrison Ford, the character he plays, Paul. And a lot of the episodes are dealing with Paul trying to deal with that. We also have some great new arrivals in the form of Michael J. Fox and Jeff Daniels. I won't say who they are in this because that's kind of a spoiler of sorts. So season 3 so far is working pretty well in terms of the emotional problems the various characters, his friends and neighbors, are getting into. But I am left, I have to say, even though everyone is putting on a decent show in this, with a slight feeling of they didn't really need to bother. Season 2 ended perfectly. You know, there are very few shows that improve with time. The Sopranos is one, and maybe Breaking Bad. But I don't know. I thought season 2 was a perfect place to end. Shrinking fans will probably enjoy season 3. But I think you will be left with a slight lingering doubt of, should we actually have done this? Let me know if you are watching Shrinking, or indeed anything at all. The email address is screentime@newstalk.com. Now we're going to talk Wuthering Heights, but before I do, I want to mention we had a competition on the show last week where we were giving you a chance to go see a screening, a special preview screening of the new movie, The Testament of Anne Lee, starring Amanda Seyfried as a fascinating lady in the 18th century in America called Anne Lee, who kind of becomes a Shaker queen, the head of an unusual religious cult. Fascinating film. And we had a load of entries, and I just want to tell you that the lucky people attending that screening in Dublin next week are Paul Kirby in Louth, Lucy Boyle in Meath, Catherine Chamberlain in Limerick, Leisha McElroy in Wicklow, and Karen Darcy in Meath. And they're all going along to the Testament of Anne Lee this week in Dublin at a special preview screening. I will be talking to the star of The Testament of Anne Lee, the great Amanda Seyfried, next week on the show, or no, the week after. But she's coming up, trust me. Now you're listening to Screen Time, News Talk's TV and movie show. Now the big release of the week is undoubtedly the new version of Wuthering Heights. Yes, you've probably heard about it. Margot Robbie and Jacob Elordi star as Heathcliff and Catherine, respectively. I saw it early in the week, but more importantly, film critic and first time in studioer Cara O'Doherty also saw it and joins me now. Cara, how are you?
I am good, thank you very much.
So listen, my memory of the book, I did it in school, is it certainly wasn't as graphic as this movie, right?
It's not as graphic in the sense of it's not as racy, because this is very racy. But it is actually very graphic in the sense of its violence and its cruelty. It's a very dark book.
Yeah.
I mean, Cathy and Heathcliff, as much as they were great lovers, and I believe me, I love their love story, they were dangerous. They hurt each other. They hurt everybody else. And for people who aren't familiar with the story, we're not going to go too spoilery. But in towards later on in the book, somebody does dig somebody up to give them a kiss out of their grave. I mean, Emily Brontë went to dark places.
It was gothic.
It was daring. And yeah, I've always seen her. She was very much a woman ahead of her time, because she took risks and people were horrified, but they also loved it. But at the same time, she was confined by social norms. So they couldn't do the bodice ripping, because the book would never have gotten anywhere.
Yeah.
But if she was here now and writing, there'd be all the bodices would be ripped.
Just remind people, you know, in a sentence or two, who've fallen from space or whatever, and maybe like you and I didn't do it in school. The story is Heathcliff and Cathy are these great friends, almost family as children, right?
Yeah. Cathy comes from a supposedly wealthy family, except her father has drank away their wealth. But she's still, they're still quite a well-renowned family. And she's very young when her drunken father brings home a little boy. I mean, quite of a questionable, people get drunk and they bring home a bag of chips, but in this case, it's a child, and sort of says, there's your plaything.
Yeah.
And this boy, Heathcliff, becomes a servant who becomes her plaything, but more importantly, he becomes her best friend.
Yeah.
And he also becomes her defense mechanism, because her father's violent and Heathcliff takes all the punches for her. But she's very dramatic and she's very wild and she's very willful. She's not the average child of her time either. So the two of them together form this remarkable bond. But when they get that bit older, that bond changes from childish ways to lustful ways.
Yes. And so the film, so far so good. Does the film, well, I've seen it, but you tell our listeners, does the film play with that or change that?
It speeds it up a little. So the book famously begins with a very ghostly supernatural element. All of the supernatural elements have been stripped away.
Yeah.
It's where we go dive straight into those early days. So it follows very much the first two thirds of the book. Emerald Fennell, like many other directors, has chosen not to show us anything from the sort of the last third of the book. Most of them do stop at a certain point. And I think that's probably just as well, because to go into that territory, you're talking miniseries.
Yeah.
Or three films, and nobody really needs that.
Yeah. So in the movie then, we have Margot Robbie and Jake Elordi playing these two, you know, doomed lovers, let's call them. Did you find them believable as star-crossed lovers?
I did, yeah. So there's the whole big furore online that Margot Robbie is too old to play Cathy. In the book, she is significantly younger. That didn't bother me at all. No. And I think there was, I'm going to say it, I think there was some misogyny at play there. Mm. I mean, she's now in her 30s. She's starting to be over the hill, according to the internet.
I actually hadn't read that.
Yeah, it's quite shocking. There's a lot of that. There was also some talk that perhaps Jacob Elordi was a little too wooden. Now, anybody who has seen any of his work in recent years, he's not just a handsome one-trick pony. So together, their chemistry is very fiery.
Yeah.
And then obviously, the story changes when another family comes into the mix, the Linton family who live across the moor, and they still have their money and they have this fine, lavish lifestyle. And Cathy starts to see that life and she's like, oh, wouldn't mind a little bit of that. So she finagles away to visit the house and encounters our own Alison Oliver playing Isabella.
She's from Cork.
She's from Cork. And she was also in Saltburn, so she's an Emerald Fennel two-timer. And she's besotted with her because she's like, oh, a new plaything. And Cathy begins to see this world of finery and potential and things she could have. And the man of the house takes a liking to her. And she now has that decision. Does she take a life that is lavish and with no drunken father and pretty dresses? Or does she go back home to Wuthering Heights and make a life with Heathcliff, which will probably be a life of drudgery and misery? And or will it be? Dun, dun, dun.
Yeah. And anyone who's read the book knows, like, it's not a spoiler. She decides to marry Edgar. And therein lies the problem, right?
Yes. And you know, you can't blame her at the time.
No.
She didn't have much of a choice, really. She makes that decision and Heathcliff does a runner. And he comes back later and he has made himself into a gentleman. Mm. So now he is respectable. But he knows by coming back, he is going to ruffle more than a few feathers.
Yes.
And he knows that Cathy will be tormented by his presence. And she is.
She really is.
She really is.
Yeah.
And it becomes this thing of, can these doomed lovers come back together despite the fact that she is now a very happily, well, supposedly happily married woman.
Yeah. And all the finery she wanted all along. But did she actually? Okay. That's a great synopsis of what's going on. So did it work for you?
Absolutely. So it is a bit.
And you're a big fan of the book, right?
I'm a diehard. I'm going to make a confession here. When I was younger, I used to sit with an inkwell and a calligraphy pen and write quotes from it and stick them up on my wall. This is how much I loved this story.
Wow.
Yeah.
An ink pen, blotting paper, all that.
The whole lot. Sitting there quoting after quoting. Yeah. It got me fired, didn't it? So, I mean, this is a film for me.
Yeah.
And yet, as somebody who's a diehard of the book, I know there's diehards that will grumble about this. But I think that Emerald Fennel has taken this story and done with it what Emily Bronte would love it to see.
Okay.
It is very racy. It's very sexy.
Yeah.
It's a bit bold. They're tempestuous. They're fiery. It's a little bit exaggerated, but so too is the book. I mean, the book is all about extremes, and this is what the film does. It pushes to extremes.
I thought their chemistry really worked. They were believable as a couple who were bad and good for each other. And they loved each other from childhood. And I thought that really came across. I thought it was perfect casting in lots of ways.
Yeah. And Emerald Fennel has said that when she was filming Saltburn, she looked over one day at Jacob Elordi with his sideburns and kind of went, oh God, that's the Heathcliff I saw on my book when I was a teenager.
Mm.
So this is something that she has wanted to do something tells me she was sitting there with her inkwell writing the words too. So she's very much created her vision of it.
Yeah.
I mean, maybe it's something to do with reading it at a certain point, but there's a particular tree in the book and she captures it exactly how I thought it would be. It's quite a hyper-realistic tree.
Mm.
And I always thought it would be this big stark tree in the middle of the moors. And
yeah.
It's exactly that. I'm like, Emerald Fennel, did you jump inside my brain? Can I get some credit here? Because I don't know.
this pleased you deeply.
Yeah, it really did.
It's dividing people.
Completely, yeah.
And some of the critics are saying that you alluded to the supernatural elements. There's very little of that in it.
Yeah.
But that clearly didn't bother you.
I think that's a hard sell
nowadays.
And I think it's very much a decision to leave that out.
Yes.
But if you go down that route, you know, you are creating a different film altogether.
Yeah, horror elements.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And I think there's enough horror within its own self in their darkness.
And as a lover of the book who wrote passages of it with her ink pen. Well, all pens of ink, but you know what I mean. Any of the flourishes she's taken with it clearly don't bother you. And her reimagining of it suits you.
Yeah, it does. Because we also know that Emerald Fennell is a director who has very distinct ways of making films.
Yeah.
We know it's an Emerald Fennell film.
Yeah, definitely.
There's certain things she's going to do. And there seems to be quite a backlash. I've heard a lot of people say it's very much an Emerald Fennell film. And yet, these are the same people who go, yay, it's a Tarantino film with all of his or Soderbergh.
Yeah.
I mean, his films have their hallmarks
absolutely,
all the way through.
Yeah.
But there's this very strong thing of, well, there's a woman. She can't be doing that now. I won't start now. I get annoyed. But there is a lot of that building as well. And there's also a lot of commentary about, that this is a film for women because of the bodice ripping, to be polite. But even, what exactly is wrong with that? I mean, it can't all be pretty Bridgerton corset moving.
No, indeed.
Well,
you're saying for women. I was talking to Claire Byrne earlier in the week and I said, I wish I'd seen this movie when I was 14 instead of reading it in school when I was 14. It would have appealed to my young 14-year-old self a lot more. One of the things I really liked about it was, and I thought Margot Robbie was terrific in it, and I wasn't aware people were saying she was too old. That is absurd. But Jacob Elordi, the Heathcliff character, loves her, but he's horrible as well. He carries that off brilliantly.
He does.
Especially towards the end of
the film. It's a very hard line to get right.
Yes.
Because somebody who is so horrible, where do they find the depth to still love? But it just shows you how strong his love is for Kathy. He would literally lay it down and die. He'd tear up the world for her if he could. He just doesn't care. He's pretty, pretty nasty.
So, as a big fan of the book, as I say, who wrote passages, put them on our wall, what would you say stars-wise out of 5?
I think my heart would love to give it a 5. I can't do that, the odd moment, before a very strong 4.
I'd completely go along with that. So, that is 4 stars, according to Cara O'Doherty. I go along with it as well, for the new version of Wuthering Heights, which is in cinemas right now. So go and see it, according to Cara and to myself. Cara, thanks a million.
Most welcome.
You must be very rich indeed. I suppose you shall fall in love with me. I suppose you shall fall in love with
you.
It would be nice to be rich. What should you do, Heathcliff?
What?
If you were rich?
Suppose I'd do what all rich men do. I'd live in a big house. And be cruel to my servants. Take a wife.
A wife? What wife?
I've always looked fondly on Rose from the Crown.
The landlord's daughter. She's quite the plainest girl I ever laid eyes on, and dull too, shockingly dull. She's practically a simpleton. I cannot sit here all day talking nonsense with you. After all, the Lintons may call on me at any moment.
Margot Robbie and Jacob Elordi there. Two very believable Heathcliffs and Kathy in the new version of Wuthering Heights, which is on in, I imagine, just about every cinema in Ireland. And it worked for Cara O'Doherty and it worked for me. Up next, a completely different movie that's also in cinemas this week called Whistle. Now you're welcome back to Screen Time News Talk's TV and movie show. Now, opening this Friday and a world away from Wuthering Heights is Whistle, about a misfit group of unwitting high school students who stumble upon a cursed object, an ancient Aztec death whistle. They discover that blowing the whistle and the terrifying sound it emits will summon their future deaths, as in how they might die, to hunt them down. As the body count rises, the friends investigate the origins of this deadly artifact in a desperate effort to stop the horrifying chain of events they have set in motion. It stars Daphne Keane as Chris, a new arrival to the local area who has some troubles of her own she may be on the run from. We also have the great Nick Frost in there playing a school teacher. This was directed by Corin Hardy, who previously directed the wildly popular popular The Nun and the terrific horror debut that was filmed largely in Ireland, The Hallow. And I'm delighted to say Corin joins me now. Corin, hi, how are you?
Hey, I'm very well, John. Nice to be here.
So listen, I gather the idea of a Aztec death whistle is actually an artifact that existed in antiquity. Like, you could find this, and yet it's never been dealt with in a horror movie before. Is that correct?
To my knowledge, that's correct, which was one of the sort of big, appeals and things that made me excited about taking on a project like this. Because when you're looking for horror stories and mythologies, it's rare to come across something that you haven't seen the movie of. So this is the Death Whistle movie.
Yeah, it certainly is. And look, it's, you know, blood and guts and horror. So I don't want to get too wildly philosophical, but I was really fascinated by this idea of how you're going to die and you're going to come face to face with that. I presume that was kind of an intriguing idea for a horror person like yourself.
Absolutely. And it was, I guess there was sort of three main aspects to why I wanted to do this movie. One was the aforementioned sort of featured cursed ancient object, the death whistle. And the other was this mythology that had been sort of crafted by Owen Edgerton, the writer, which is, you know, as you explained, if you hear the sound of the whistle, your future death will come and hunt you down. And it being specific to your future fate, it makes it quite personal. It makes it quite, it gave it a little bit of a deeper contemplation, you know, to think what yours or mine or our, fate might be. And in this case, it gets brought much quicker than what it might have been in real life. And it comes for you.
And more that you might have hoped for as well. We'll have to be very careful. We're going to start using that slightly pretentious phrase, elevated horror. So I'll steer clear.
I'm not going to use that phrase. That phrase doesn't exist to me, but it's a horror film.
Exactly. It's a horror film. Tell me this, right? So I thought when I was watching it, I thought of The Breakfast Club and I thought of The Lost Boys. And I really, The Lost Boys is one of my favorite movies. I remember getting it on VHS as a kid, you know? And I was thinking, oh, I'm very clever. I'll say this to Corin. He'll be delighted that I've mentioned these. And then I read a couple of interviews with you this morning and you've claimed that all along. So
I'm thrilled. You nailed it.
But the one that I was surprised about, and I was wondering if you might explain it to me, was you mentioned the deer hunter. Tell me about the deer hunter in this movie as you see it.
I absolutely love the deer hunter, but I can't say I've ever mentioned it in relation to this movie.
Okay.
So I'm not sure what you're referencing. I have mentioned a number of different movies and inspirations. And I've mentioned Donnie Darko and I've mentioned Nightmare on Elm Street and Fast Times at Ridgemont High and The Breakfast Club and Fright Night. And I do love The Deer Hunter, but I can't possibly think of a way of connecting them.
Well, you see, I was thinking maybe you were going to say that now, unless the internet's wrong, and we both know that could never be the case and there was something wrong up online. But I thought maybe you were going to say that where the movie takes place is kind of a down at heel America.
Okay.
And maybe it's similar to the place the guys come from, but I don't know.
No. Now I sound crazy. Okay. I may have mentioned it, but I mean, I can't think. I've certainly not mentioned it in an interview for a while. I might have mentioned it in the, it might be in some liner notes, but yes. Okay. The steel town that Whistle takes place in, the fictional steel town of Pellington. I have mentioned The Deer Hunter, so I take that back. I thought you meant in relation to sort of film comparisons, but in terms of the production design, when creating a world for any movie, and particularly with Whistle being that it's an American high school movie, as well as having the high school as a setting itself, the surrounding area was really important, and I wanted to get the feel of a kind of world that these kids probably wouldn't escape, even if this terrible curse wouldn't have befallen upon them.
Yeah.
And when I was doing location scouting, we found a place called Hamilton, which is outside of Toronto on the way to Niagara. And immediately as I went over the horizon was this incredible steel mill. And one of the characters, Rel, is said to have worked, or he was going to be working in a sawmill, like a wood sawmill. But the minute I saw the steel mill, and I thought, oh, actually, let's make this a steel town. And that is the reference to the Deer Hunter, because I've always loved that that sequence in the Deer Hunter where it sort of sets up this environment and these men working. So that would be the connection with the Deer Hunter. Thank you. You're right.
Okay. Now we have it. We're good. In terms of the movie itself, so, you know, it's a high school kind of set horror, and we have this gang of misfits led principally by Daphne. What I found strange in a good way was, and I don't want to give any kind of spoiler,
yeah,
but when it began, I was a bit like, what's this? So without giving a spoiler, but let's say it begins as nearly a sports movie and then gets really creepy, you know, about 3 minutes in. Was that you saying, I'm going to play with people's expectations here?
Yeah, I mean, it was, again, credit to Owen Edgerton and his writing. I loved that it began in this extremely energetic basketball sequence, without spoiling too much. But, you know, it had this energy, and it was like, you know, it was like a sports movie like Rocky or something, where you begin in the end of this kind of really like exhausting match that's just been played, and you meet what you think, well, don't want to spoil anything, you meet the lead character and you see what happens as it takes you into the sort of horror film aspect. So I thought it was very original to sort of start and also feature, you know, one of the first sort of horror sequences in a very brightly lit, very public, large open space, which you never really see in a horror movie like that. You normally, everything's in the dark, in the shadows, in a contained, smaller, more claustrophobic setting, which also will happen in different ways in Whistle. But so that was also a really exciting sequence to visualize and start, kick off the movie with.
Yeah, well, it absolutely works. And listen, not to give any kind of spoiler, but as the action heats up, there is a big section of the movie that takes place at this event, the Harvest Festival, right? Yeah. We don't have to say what happens. But
that's all right, yeah.
And that was where I was getting the Lost Boys vibe from it and all. But that looked like it was probably a logistical nightmare to put together, was it?
You're very attuned, John. You obviously are, both with the Lost Boys reference, which Lost Boys was a very sort of key inspiration and influence and touchstone. Although Lost Boys isn't necessarily a high school horror movie, it features that age. And I was the age when I saw Lost Boys where I really wanted to like be in the Lost Boys, and me and my friends, we grew up as sort of like rockers making horror movies, and we very much could associate ourselves with the gang and the vampires and you know, the way they looked and everything. Yeah. So but the movie, the way it's shot, Michael Chapman shot that film, did Scorsese's Taxi Driver and Raging Bull, and it's beautifully photographed. It's kind of quite rich in color. It has a silver kind of look to it that I hadn't seen much in films these days. And it's quite sumptuous in a lot of ways and inventive. And the tone of it has this energy, both in the young cast and in the kind of in the storytelling. So it was an influence like that. And the Harvest Festival, this was in Owen's script, you know, I love that there was a central event that took you out of the high school. I love environments and scale coming into my films. And to stage one of the horror set pieces of one of our characters being hunted down in the setting of the Harvest Festival was very attractive to me. But also all of the emotions that go with that. I have vivid memories of going to bonfire nights as a sort of, you know, kind of outsider, romantic teenager getting my heart broken. and kind of that night was always very kind of like heightened and romantic, and the fireworks going off and the colors and hanging out with his friends at school in that kind of environment. So I was really pleased to be able to kind of draw upon that stuff and put it into a movie.
Yeah.
No, and it was a logistical nightmare because we really went for it. We built an entire fairground for two nights, long night shoots to do the exteriors. And then Jen Spence, my production designer, built a 10-foot high straw bale maze in five sections, including the central area, for all these different stunts and set pieces and chases, and populated it with a lot of different extras and costumes. So it was a lot of planning, storyboarding, pre-visualizing, props departments, costume, set design, and Bjorn Charpentier's cinematography all kind of coming together to make it happen.
Yeah. Well, it paid off. I gather you were making movies from an early age. Were you watching a huge amount of movies as a teenager? It sounds like you probably were.
Yeah, for sure. I mean, originally I was sort of captivated by monsters from watching King Kong at a very early age, about age six or so. And then it kind of took me through the sort of Star Wars, Indiana Joneses, and Ray Harryhausen monster movies. And I kind of got into horror when I was about 11 or 12. And it became this sort of obsession and this sort of challenge to watch. Particularly the more imaginative kind of movies like The Thing and Evil Dead 2 and Alien and The Nightmare on Elm Streets were, you know, like a big part of that period of teenage movie watching, and The Lost Boys and, you know, Fright Night and The Blob, and the slasher movies and Friday the 13th and Halloween. So, it became a really big part of me and my group of friends, and we would get together at the weekends and in the summer holidays with their Super 8 camera and then eventually a VHS Ferguson Video Star when that became available. And we would sort of combine our pocket monies to sort of fund the Super 8 reels and the hire of the video camera and, you know, write up stories and storyboard them. And basically it was a sort of a way of trying to recreate movies that we loved watching, like Evil Dead 2 or Dawn of the Dead and you know, Friday the 13th Part 6, and try and recreate the special effects and the gore and the monsters. And then we realized you had to tell a story around that as well.
Yeah. That bit came later, I guess. Well, that sounds like, you know, the perfect biography of a filmmaker who gave us things like The Nun and Whistle. Finally, then, you had this strange time, and well, maybe it wasn't strange at all, but you made music videos in the early days, and you made some very popular ones, like For Keane, their first big hit, The Prodigy. Is that a weird kind of thing to do? I often think video directors probably don't get the credit they deserve, because, you know, the rock star goes out on stage and picks up the Grammys or whatever.
Well, I think weird is good. So
yes,
I can say it was weird, but it was good. I mean, it was really, I didn't go to film school. So in a lot of ways, my early childhood experiments making horror movies and short films led me to go to art school and do theater design and study special effects and monster making. And when I came out of that, I made a stop motion animated short film that was took 5 years to make, called Butterfly, which is 30 minutes long. Pure stop motion. And that got me into a film festival in Edinburgh Film Festival, and that led to music videos. And so music videos became kind of my film school. So roughly 10-year period from sort of 2004 to 2014, I'd say, just before The Hallow, was making music videos. And I got a chance to really experiment lots of techniques and work with lots of different artists and, you know, try out film narratives, dramas, work with actors, do stop motion, do animation. So it was a chance to work with crews and, you know, get experience professionally and work with bands I loved, like Biffy Clyro and The Prodigy and music videos for The Horrors and McFly. And it was a good sort of balance of, I suppose, being able to still experiment, but also have sort of professional crews and production sort of experience. And that helped when I was putting together my feature films to have work to show.
Yeah, I can imagine. It all worked out. If you're looking for something different to Wuthering Heights in this week's visit to your local cinema, you would do a lot worse than going seeing Whistle. I've been talking to its director, Corin Hardy. Corin, thanks a million.
Thank you so much. Yes, Whistling Heights. Go see Whistle this weekend. It is a romantic movie. You can take your date on to see a Valentine's horror movie.
Absolutely. Well said. No.
Can you hear me? Can you translate any of it?
To talk? It can also mean to...
Summon the dead.
Go for it, babe. I dare you.
Do it.
I think I'm going to pass on the whole ghost summoning death whistle.
Listen, you guys hear that?
The day you are born, so is your death. If you hear the whistle scream, dying is not a choice.
Hello?
A clip there from Whistle, and you heard me talking to the very interesting Corin Hardy there about Whistle, which is in cinemas from this very weekend, the 13th of February. Up next, Oscar nominee John Kelly on his Oscar-nominated short film, Retirement Plan. Now, you're welcome back to Screen Time News Talk's TV and movie show. Now, this is the only dedicated film and TV show on national radio. I say that not as an idle boast, but rather to highlight the fact that it has been incredibly remiss of me to be only speaking to my next guest now. John Kelly is the writer and director of the Oscar-nominated short film Retirement Plan. Retirement Plan is a beautifully simple short story, a short film as well, which in very pleasingly simple animation, we see Ray pondering the things he's going to do once he's retired. Narrated by Donald Gleason, Kelly relates the story of Ray's life by telling us not what he's accomplished, but what he hasn't and what he's planning to do, from writing poetry, meditating, microdosing drugs, and even going for a hike. And it may give viewers pause to consider their own future. It's simply delightful. And in a time when people, and myself included, bemoan the length of things, Retirement Plan comes in just under 8 minutes. I'm delighted to say, following yesterday's Oscar luncheon, which he attended, John Kelly joins me from an early LA now. Good morning, John.
Hi, John. Thanks for having me.
No problem. I got to start with the Oscar luncheon because I knew it was on yesterday. I saw pictures of people like Jesse Buckley there. Was it everything you hoped it would be?
It was lovely. Yes, it was a very brain-bending experience seeing so many famous people in one room together. But they're all lovely and friendly and approachable.
And I presume you ate as well, right? Or you weren't too nervous to eat?
Yeah, it's a little bit like a wedding arrangement, you know, with table numbers and except a wedding with about 1,000 photographers outside. And you know, you're seated with people in a similar category. So I was at a table beside the producers of Elio, who were lovely, and a makeup artist from the Ugly Stepsister, and some short form documentary people.
Okay. And is there booze at it?
There is, yes, there is booze.
Okay.
And there's lots of nice nibbles. And,
okay.
And then they call you up onto stage for a giant group. They call it the Oscar class photo.
Okay.
Yeah.
Class of 2026.
Yeah. And there wasn't one last year because of the wildfires. There was no luncheon. It was cancelled.
Okay.
And so I think people really, they all seem to really enjoy getting together. There's no press in the room, so it's a bit more laid back, I think, than the Oscars event itself.
Okay, terrific. So listen, let's get to Retirement Plan. As I said, I loved it, and I only got around to watching it yesterday. You've probably discussed the genesis of it many times, and I've read a few bits about it, but top line, you were on a plane meditating on your own place in the universe about what you had done, what you still hope to do, and the idea came to you. Is that a close enough approximation, or would you like to say more about its genesis?
No, that's pretty much it. It's, you know, the character in the film has this bleak awareness that he wouldn't be able to achieve everything he wants to do in life before he died. And I basically had the same little moments. At the risk of sounding dramatic, I had that same awareness. And I think I probably should have gone to therapy, but instead decided to make short film.
And how long has this short film been around? When did you make it?
Yeah, so we got funding from Screen Ireland in 2023, and then it premiered at the Galway Film Flat in 2024. And then we kind of, like, there's so much strategy involved in festival selection. And, you know, what we were hearing was, unless you have a big splashy international premiere, then the film can kind of get submerged. Because making a short film is a little bit like putting a message in a bottle. There's so many of these made.
Sure.
It's very hard to, I think Sundance had like 12,000 short film submissions for 35 places. So it's ridiculous. So we actually waited after Galway almost 8 months until we found, you know, until we were lucky enough to get into South by Southwest last year, 2025. And so that kind of really helped launch the film internationally. And so, yeah, it's been out for a while. And then we submitted it to the Oscars in August.
Yeah. And I watched it. Well, I won't tell you how I watched it because, you know, that's not important. But I know it's on Disney Plus. So presumably that's a big deal.
It's amazing. Yeah, it's great. And yeah, seeing it sort of alongside, you know, some of their weightier films in the award section is pretty
your
surreal.
Movie beside Darth Vader must be quite
all right. Yeah, someone was saying they should get a retirement plan ride at Euro Disney, but I think it would probably break down midway through.
Might move quite slowly.
Yeah.
I mentioned the animation as being gorgeously simple, and I hope you don't take that as a criticism. I'm sure you don't. It's gorgeous. Did the character emerge from the animation, or was it the other way around?
Yeah, I mean, I think my background is I've been kind of directing animation, mostly commercials and stuff, for the last 18 years. And so I've been fortunate enough to try everything, you know, stop motion, puppetry, live action sort of stuff. And with this film, it was a bit of a pendulum swing away from that. The film, you kind of just have to listen to what the film tells you it wants to be. You know, and this just felt like, okay, I think I need to use my drawings, which is the first time I've ever used my drawings really beyond storyboard, and trying to do more with less.
Yeah.
You know, I love documentary is the kind of thing I keep coming back to. I met Andrew Jarecki. I went up to him yesterday.
The man who gave us The Jinx and Capturing the Friedmans. And
exactly. I just went up and told him how much I loved his work. And, you know, I love, you know, the Maisels brothers and Lance Oppenheim stuff and John Wilson, you know. So I wanted something that was a bit more observational for this, because the character is going through these little introspective moments. And with animation, it's so easy to overload it technically with, you know, swirling cameras and talking animals and all that sort of stuff. But I think we just wanted to actually see how little we could get away with, so that the message, the emotional core, could come through a little bit.
And I mean, it's probably a movie of no country, I was thinking. Like, there's, you know, I know there's an Irish actor voicing it and you're Irish, but it's very universal, because this man pottering and pondering could really be in any, you know, certainly Western country.
Yeah, I think that's the beauty of animation.
Yeah.
And, you know, graphic novels as well.
Sure.
You know, people like Chris Ware or Daniel Clowes and stuff like that. You strip away the specifics and it's much easier to see yourself in it. I mean, the design of the characters, his eyes are literally just two dots. And, you know, Donald Gleason, who you mentioned, was talking the other day about how when he gets older in the film, slight spoiler, you know, that's just shown by two lines down his face, and he's a bit more hunched. And it's just lovely to see how, you can strip stuff back, but then you fill in the rest as a viewer a little bit.
Absolutely. Yeah. And that's, I think, why it works so well. And I'm not going to say what it is. You mentioned spoilers. It's a great ending. Really is terrific ending. But let's move on. Let's step back from the abyss before the abyss starts looking back to misquote Nietzsche. Tell me this, to be crude, and I'll make another quote. Leonard Cohen said, you know, you can't have art without commerce. I imagine most short movies don't make a huge amount of money. Given what's behind this, are you making a little money off this?
No, is the short answer.
Okay, good.
No, I still, my day job is still, you know, directing commercials. It would be lovely to make longer form animation like this, and that would probably be the route into making a living out of it. And I hope I can do that. I mean, sure. The lovely thing about this sort of Oscars fuss is that the phone has started ringing from lots of interesting people. And so I have a lot of ideas that I've been working up, and also with my co-writer Tara on Retirement Plan, we have a few things. You know, the process of making the film was so liberating. It's a way I've never done animation before. You know, not to get too nerdy about technical pipelines, but it suddenly made me think, my God, it's so easy to do a feature film or a feature documentary. My next project is an animated documentary short.
Wow. Okay.
Yeah.
Well, we look forward to that. Tell me this. This isn't meant to be loads of name droppings, but it's just the way it's coming out. Dave Fanning said once to me that the stupidest question he ever asked an actor was Richard Dreyfuss, when he said to him, what was it like to win an Oscar for Goodnight Girl? And he said, what do you think it was like? It was great. It was terrific. What a silly question. But I'm going to ask you a silly question. I presume you really hope you win.
Yeah, it's a funny one, isn't it? I'm not a competitive person, but part of me, you know, you suddenly find yourself in this Oscars race, and it's hard not to start caring.
Sure.
And because so many people, you know, the lollipop ladies at my kid's school are saying congratulations, and the woman in Spar who served me so many times is, you know, and we're finally on name terms, which is lovely. And, you know, so suddenly everyone is rooting for you, and it's hard not to start caring yourself. But yeah, it would be lovely. It would be really lovely, of course.
Yes.
I don't know where I'd put it, but that's... That's me getting lost in logistics, getting ahead of myself. Well,
you know what Robin Williams says, or said, God bless him, it's nice, it holds the mail. So, you know, you could use it for the post. Well, listen, I really hope you do win. I've been talking to the writer and director of Retirement Plan, which, as I mentioned, is on Disney Plus. Watch it after you listen to this show. I've been talking to its writer and director, John Kelly. John, thanks a million.
Thanks so much, John.
When I retire, I will reply to every email I've ever flagged. I will clean up my desktop. I'll read the 35 years of saved articles on my reading list. I will finish all those books I started. I will play the lifetime of computer games I missed out on. I'll birdwatch. I'll learn magpies are beautiful, but terrifying.
A clip there from Retirement Plan. Do yourself a favor. It's a great watch. I know short movies maybe aren't something that you think about that often. This is absolutely delightful, and it has a terrific ending. And I won't even say what it is, but I just love the way it ended. A terrific watch that you can see on Disney Plus now. That's it for this week. If you want to get in touch with me at any stage, you can email me screentime@newstalk.com. Now, leave you with a little music from the TV this week. And at the start of the show, I was talking about Shrinking and its new season, season 3. Even though I thought it wasn't that necessary to have a third season, it does have an amazing soundtrack. The title theme, it's unusual song title called Frightening Fishes, sung by Benjamin Gibbard, who's actually the lead singer of Death Cab for Cutie. But it is a great theme song to a mostly great TV show. So I'll leave you with this Frightening Fishes and wish you a happy remainder to your weekend.
These days I've been barely holding on, climbing the walls every dusk till dawn, fearing the future, mourning the past, the hours moving slowly and vanishing fast.